I'm Liz Corey.
And I'm Katie King.
And this is
True Crime New England,
Case Profiles Edition.
Hello, welcome back to another mini episode.
Thank you for joining us on this beautiful Holy Sunday morning. So glad to have you here. As always, it is so, so important to us that you're here and listening to these cases. It means the world to us.
Yes. If you are not familiar with our many episodes, our case profiles, it is where we tell you and each other about cases of people of color in New England who just did not get the same media coverage, attention from the media, or attention from law enforcement. And as a result, most of the cases we cover in our many episodes are unsolved.
This is very true. It is no secret that New England is predominantly white. We've talked about this many, many times, and that is to no fault of New England. However, as it is with most of America, these cases are swept under the rug and just do not get that media attention, like Katie just said. We don't know why. Is it because America is still racist, largely? I think that's the case, and it's unfortunate. So the goal of our case profiles, whether it is vocally on an episode or just a post on our Instagram and our website, is to bring awareness to these cases and get as much information out there as we can to try and get them solved. If they are unsolved, if they are solved, even just to bring attention to them, because those victims deserve justice. We cover everything from murders to abductions to disappearances to suspicious deaths. All of these people deserve justice and deserve to have their stories told. And we can do a lot with very little. Most of the time we have 1, 2, 3 sources, and we will do everything we can to tell these stories. So typically what happens is I will tell a story that Katie has not heard, and neither have you, hopefully, lovely listeners. And Katie will tell me a story that I have never heard, and to you, lovely listeners, as well. And today, because it is an odd number, and I went first last week, Katie, it's your turn to start our episode off today with a case I'm sure, to nobody's surprise, is really sad and awful.
This one is really sad and awful.
Oh, good.
I will be telling you, Liz, as well as our lovely listeners, about the Chelsea Jane Doe.
Oh.
My sources today include Boston 25 News, Unidentified Wiki, National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, The Washington Post, and Stories of the Unsolved.
That was so many sources.
5.
Wow. That might be a record.
I was going to say that might be. I think we've done 1 or 2 with 5.
5, yeah.
But that's up there.
That is a lot.
Mm-hmm. On November 13th, the year 2000, Chelsea, Massachusetts Police Chief Keyes arrived on scene at a parking lot in the back of the Soldiers' Home on Crest Avenue in Chelsea, Massachusetts. In the parking lot, he found a blanket. He pulled back the blanket and found the body of a young woman who was missing her head, her hands, and her feet.
You were right. This is quite upsetting. Wow.
It was determined that the woman had been dead for at least 24 hours, and she was believed to be between the ages of 17 to 25.
Oh my God.
They thought that she weighed about 100 to 130 pounds, and that she was about 5'2 to 5'5 in height.
Yeah.
Authorities believe that she was a Black female with possible Asian, Cape Verdean, or Indian ancestry. Police eventually were led to a former truck driver named Eugene McCollum, who had admitted to murdering and beheading a man named John Lydon the year after this, in 2001. He was arrested in August of that same year for the murder of John.
Okay.
And they're like, wow, this method of this murder seems to really fit this. You know, let's talk to him and see if he knows anything about our Jane Doe. And Eugene told police, he's like, yeah, I hired her as a sex worker.
Oh.
And he said he picked her up in the combat zone section of Boston on November 11th, 2000. And he took her to his very small room where he was staying at the YMCA in Lynn, Massachusetts. And the two started arguing over money. He was trying to shortchange her. She was like, no, you promised me this. I'm all the way here. Just pay me and I'll do what we talked about. Eugene proceeded to strangle her. He then beheaded her body and mutilated it. And when asked why, he stated, quote, I really have no idea. I was just experimenting with the knife.
Oh, my God.
Eugene said that the only information he knew about the woman was that she said that her name was Lisa and she was from Philadelphia.
Okay, so Lisa's one of the most common names for a woman at that time.
Right. And she's a sex worker, so she could have just said Lisa.
Right.
And not given out her real name.
Right.
Officer Keyes stated, quote, he was claiming self-defense. He was claiming the victim in this case got a hold of a knife that he had in the room and tried to attack him. He gave some account that he's living in a small room. He had to dispose of the body. So in his own wisdom, decided the only way he could do that was to take her out in pieces.
No.
Eugene pled guilty to second-degree murder and was sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole after 15 years in February of 2005.
What?
Eugene is a suspect in multiple other murders involving beheadings and mutilation extending all the way down to Miami, Florida.
Whoa.
Mm-hmm.
Holy shit.
The woman's head, hands, and feet were later found buried in a plastic container at the beach in the North Shore town of Nahant, Massachusetts in January of 2004.
Whoa.
Based on this finding, they were able to add more information to Lisa's description. She had short black hair with a reddish tint, likely from hair dye. She had several dental fillings and a slight overbite that might have been noticeable to others when she was smiling or speaking, and her toenails were painted purple. Robert Lowry from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children feels that it's likely that Lisa was in foster care and was a victim of child sex trafficking. This would explain why it seems like no one is looking for her or concerned about her whereabouts or has reported anyone fitting her description as missing.
That's awful.
Yep.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm. Christy Andrews, a forensic artist with the Center of Missing and Exploited Children, was able to finally recreate a facial reconstruction image of Lisa's face once her head was found to help identify her. She stated, quote, we don't want this individual to sit there with a number. We don't want them to be a number. We want them to be a name. Anyone with any information about the identity of the Chelsea Jane Doe is asked to please call Massachusetts State Police at 978-745-8908, the Suffolk County State Police Detective Unit at 617-727-8817, or the Massachusetts Office of the Medical Examiner at 617-267-6767.
Wow.
And that is the horrific case of the Chelsea Jane Doe.
Oh my God.
Who likely was a vulnerable individual. I do completely think that she was in foster care.
Oh yeah. She sounds like she was probably on the lower end of that age guesstimate. That's terrible.
Yeah. So she was likely 17 in the system.
They think they can link that man for sure. He pled guilty.
Yeah.
He is charged with it. Did he lead them to her head and wow.
Someone just found it. They were like, oh I'm digging up something on the beach. Oh my God. It's a head. And hands and feet. So I think he put it in a container and threw it in the water.
Yeah.
And then someone found it when it washed up. Which, thank God, because
right.
Now we're able to... We have a composite image of what she could look like.
Right.
We have, like, multiple other pieces of information, like her dental records and a slight overbite. And the fact that, like, her face, what it looks like, and her hair, and the detail about the hair dye.
Yeah.
Like, if they hadn't found that container...
Yeah. There'd be a lot less
to go
off of.
We wouldn't have an image. So we know what she looks like. But the most frustrating thing is that it really seems like no one is looking for her.
And, you know, the thing is, too, is that she could have been, I think you're right. I think she probably was in foster care, maybe was sex trafficked. Maybe there was another child or young girl that she was with or knew very well. Like, you know, they buddy up and they have to. You have to have like a buddy system. Maybe there was someone she was with or knew well that, if they found this information, would be like, wait a second, that's Lisa Montgomery, I don't know, who I was in the foster care system with. Last time I saw her, she had just dyed her hair with the spikes red or whatever, and she always had her toenails painted purple or whatever. And like, it sometimes it just takes that, you know, and maybe it's true, maybe she's not being looked for because of the foster care system, but it also could be that. Maybe someone like that, like I just said, could stumble upon that information and be like, oh my God, when I had a terrible childhood and was sex trafficked and now I'm an adult and I'm out of it, or maybe still in, I don't know, but sees, oh my God.
Yeah.
That is terrible.
Crazy.
I hated every second of that. That is the worst thing. I feel so bad for this girl. And I can't believe how nonchalant this Eugene guy was. Oh yeah. Oh yeah, just... I was experimenting with the night. What?
Right. Like, oh yeah, I had to take her out of my apartment in pieces.
No. No.
Yep.
What a piece of shit.
Horrendous.
And he was in jail for cutting up a man, you said?
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how many more can be linked to him. Truly. Because clearly that wasn't his first time.
Right, and he was a truck driver, so he had access to... Like, they thought he could be responsible for other murders, beheadings, mutilations, whatever, all the way down to Miami.
Yeah, and I bet you he was.
So, serial killer.
That's awful.
Mm-hmm. Liz, what sad and appalling story do you have to tell us today?
I'm going to tell you guys about the murder of Christopher Barros. And I've been on a kind of a streak lately of solved cases.
Oh, thank God.
Which is refreshing. Doesn't take away from how terrible they are, though. It's just, I, we have this big, long list of names, and I'll go through and I'll look them up, and if I can find enough to, like, have an episode about it, I'll do it, and then I get through it, and I'm like, oh, solved. And it's great! And it just so happens that I've been choosing these ones, and this one was solved. Still, fucking awful.
Mm-hmm.
My sources today were two articles from South Coast Today, and I actually had a case law find law.
Wow.
Which I love. It brought me a lot of resource, a lot of information. And we love our court documents here at True Crime New England. Truly. At 8:32 p.m. on October 10th, 2005, police were dispatched to Russell Street in New Bedford, Massachusetts. The call to police was due to concern. For what, Katie? Can you take a guess? Why were the police called? What did they hear?
Was it gunshots?
Yes, you're good at this. It's almost like you could be a police officer. When police arrived, they discovered 25-year-old Christopher Barros, who was laying on the ground by a picket fence in a backyard. He had been shot twice, and police noticed he had an L-shaped laceration on one of his hands, kind of like a defensive wound.
Mm-hmm.
Christopher was still alive at the scene when they arrived, and he was very quickly taken to the hospital nearby. He unfortunately did soon pass away from his wounds from the gunshots when he got to the hospital. Luckily, though, there were three witnesses to the events that led to Christopher's heinous murder. Two of these witnesses came forward immediately. They were paid $3,000 each by the New Bedford Area Chamber of Commerce as a part of a reward if they testified and helped lead to an arrest. The third witness didn't come forward until two whole years after the shooting because she was scared, which I can empathize with.
Yeah.
But she did end up testifying at the trial in exchange for financial assistance and, quote, consideration with respect for a previous drug charge. Interesting. I can empathize with being scared. And I can also understand being scared to come forward to police when you have a drug charge on your back. That would keep me from wanting to come forward as well. So when they finally got to her and were like, listen, we'll kind of look the other way. Okay, sure. These witnesses also kind of remind me of a case we did recently where Jennifer Rivera, she did not want to come forward and talk to police. And she witnessed a murder because she was scared. And then she kept getting threatened. And then she was murdered because of it. So that was what I was thinking when I was reading that. But thanks to these witnesses, it was ultimately discovered that an argument broke out between Christopher Barros and a man named Fagbemi Miranda, which took place in front of an apartment on Purchase Street where one of the witnesses lived. Fagbemi's brother, Wayne, was also nearby and joined in on the argument. Before long, Wayne went inside and he retrieved a gun, followed by, of all people, his grandmother, who was trying her very best to prevent him from going back outside. She was like, what are you doing? Stop. Like, no matter what you think is a good idea, it's not that. Like, stop with that gun. Wayne actually pushed past her, like, pushed his grandmother, jumped over the railing, and walked right up to Christopher, pointing his gun at him. Christopher was seen putting his hands up in defense and also surrender and was heard saying, are you serious, Wayne? Are you serious? It's like that. It's like that. And then a foot chase began while Segbemi followed, and the witnesses around either followed or they watched in horror. Like, I feel like if I was witness to that, I'd just be like frozen. Like, what do you do? That's terrifying. Accounts vary based on the witnesses, but once the three stopped running, it landed them in a backyard. Wayne handed the gun to his brother, Segbemi, who raised his arm and pointed the gun at Christopher again. Then the two shots were fired and Christopher was on the ground. Thanks to these witnesses, however, both Segbemi and Wayne were arrested quickly, with their subsequent trials happening in 2008 and 2013. Long time for one of them there.
Wow.
Yeah. So even though that third witness waited quite some time due to her being scared, the other two witnesses really helped kind of jumpstart the investigation and get those answers for Christopher's family and kind of some justice for him pretty fast. Wayne Miranda's trial was first in July of 2008. He was convicted of second-degree murder, assault and battery with a dangerous weapon, and unlawful possession of a firearm. And he should have been charged for pushing his grandma.
Yeah.
Because I read that and I was like, you did not just try and push your grandma.
Rude.
Yes! Come on! She was like, how brave of her, too, to be her grandson having a gun and being like, stop it right now. Ugh. Even if it was like anyone I knew that had a gun, I don't care how well I know them, I'm going to be like hiding behind a door. I don't care. Like, so brave. So Wayne was sentenced to life in prison with an additional 3 to 5 years in state prison for the illegal firearms charge, then followed by probation of 10 years if he were to get parole. At the time of his sentencing, Wayne also had pending cases for assault and battery on a correctional officer and witness intimidation. Apparently, he had A, spit on a prison guard, and B, sent his ex-girlfriend threatening letters. Yep. So that was all in the time between the murder and him being held in custody to his trial. So he, of course, got nasty with the police guard, you know, in prison, and then threatened his ex-girlfriend via snail mail because he's in jail. And so they obviously were like, yeah, you can't just do that. Like, you're still going to get in trouble, you idiot. And so he subsequently was still sentenced for those, which I'm glad for. In 2013, and it's unclear why it took 8 years, but Segbemi Miranda was convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison with no chance of parole, where he remains to this day, rightfully so. And for a while, you know, I was reading through this, and I was like, at no point did I know which one was going to shoot. All I knew was that obviously Christopher ended up dead. And it's unclear what the argument was about. But as obvious as we say before, no argument is good enough to murder someone. They were young. Christopher was 25. Segbemi and Wayne were also in their 20s. Like, they were young. So that's a life lost. And then two more lives lost as well, because now they're spending the rest of their lives in jail. So you really got to think of the consequences here before you go and push your grandma and shoot someone to death. Like, come on. And that is the tragic murder of Christopher Barros. But I do have to say, I am glad for him and his family that they have justice and at least some answers. I really don't know why it took so long for that second trial to happen, but I'm glad it did. And there was some controversy as to why those witnesses were paid. And it seemed a little sketchy at first, but I mean, to me, as far as I understand, it led to a conviction, and one of those witnesses owned the house that he was killed in front of, so that seems legit enough to me.
Yeah, and honestly, how many case profiles have we covered where we know for a fact there are multiple witnesses, and they're just sitting on their hands or whatever, and they don't want to come forward for whatever reason? Exactly. I mean, you know, everybody has their own reasoning, like, I have prior charges.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like the cops. They don't like me. Yeah. I'm here undocumented. Like, right. Whatever reason,
yeah.
There are valid reasons.
Yeah.
And then there are not valid reasons. And sometimes there are valid reasons and there is the ultimate reason, which is you have the opportunity to be a good person,
sure.
And to do the right thing and be a good Samaritan. Mm-hmm. And this person was murdered. And I am so glad that even if, you know, they got money, maybe that's what other people need to look at doing. Like, yeah, it's sketchy and
yeah,
the morals with that are questionable, but ultimately we got somebody convicted.
Yeah.
And this case is solved, which is a rarity.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm glad for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, guys, we want to know what you think about these cases. And we also want to know if you have some case profiles that you would like us to cover, no matter how small. If we can't cover it on an episode like this, we can certainly cover it on our website and our Instagram. Nothing is too small. If you can only find one article, that's okay. Send it our way. You can send it to us on Instagram, truecrimene, or you can send it to us on our email, truecrimene@gmail.com. You can go to our website, truecrimene.com. Go to our contact page. Use our handy-dandy submission tool. You can be anonymous if you want. Just for your own protection, if you're nervous about that kind of thing, we cannot trace it. We are not savvy like that. So truly, there's so many different ways to get it to us. And please, if you can, make sure it is in New England.
Yes, absolutely. Big emphasis on our call to action. We have a big old list of names. We have a bunch on there. We are always, always, always looking for more so we can keep bringing this series to you guys and hopefully get some justice for those whose cases are maybe solved and they just are underrepresented. No one's ever heard of them before. Mm-hmm. Or cases that are unsolved, which are multiple, especially for like the Jane Does. We've covered multiple of those and missing disappearances, etc. But yeah, send them our way.
Yes, absolutely. And with that, we'll see you Thursday.
Bye.
Goodbye.